You're listening to coverage from the 2008 Cattle Industry Convention and Trade Show.
Okay, I think we pretty well have got everybody settled in here, hopefully, so we're going to take off with this session. Make sure you're in the right session. This is the Creating Value session. I think you're going to find this format rather interesting. We'll do a little housekeeping before we interview our panel members or start the process. But to kind of introduce this topic, I think it certainly goes without saying in the cattle industry, there are a tremendous number of things going on in this industry. There are tremendous challenges. And I can remember a number of years ago in a former life and career when we'd go out and we'd put a lot of presentations together and focus on the whole area of cutting costs. Well, obviously, cost matters, particularly important. And there were some excellent sessions earlier today on managing costs. There'll be others during the course of the NCBA conference. But I remember a cow-calf producer coming up in one time and said, I appreciate what you guys are talking about in cutting costs, but he said, have you ever thought about talking about the opposite side of the equation, and that is how do we find ways to add value? I think that's a tremendous subject because I will contend in the cattle industry and the cow-calf industry specifically. Well, I know one thing. In a room this big, I can't talk loud. And I talk pretty loud, but I can't talk loud enough to get back. So we'll hope that we get the little deal corrected here. But the point was made by a cow-calf producer is you need to find ways of talking about added value. And I think there are some things going on in the cattle industry right now, folks, where there's that opportunity. We're going to zero in on about 7 or 8 or 9 different areas. And then we're going to zero in on any of the areas that you want to talk about or bring questions up relative to. So with the starting part here, before we get to logistics of how this is going to work too, it's going to be a little different than most cattlemen's colleges that you attend. Most cattlemen's colleges are presentations on a wide variety of subjects. This is going to be very extemporaneous. It's going to be responding to questions, the panel members responding to questions either posed, a few questions that we jotted down, or more importantly, questions that you're going to jot down. So in each of you, as you were coming in, should have received a little card. Doesn't have the word on there to ask questions or whatever, but this little card is to ask questions. Write any type of question you want. As the conversations go along, Valerie Schofield, a college student in Missouri, will be collecting these. She'll work down the center aisle, and Valerie will pick those up from you. So jot them down. We will read them off and have our panel members respond to them. So that's kind of the format. Just to give you a little background of the folks that will be commenting, and I should introduce myself here before we get further along, too. I am Larry Cora. I'm with the Certified Angus Beef Program. I am vice president in charge of the supply or production side of that company. So anything relates to that, welcome the questions there. But more importantly, the folks that will be responding to your questions. Introduce the first of those is Les Callahan. Les is the owner and founder of Crossroad Cattle Company. In Austin, Texas, I first became familiar with this group in the last couple of years with the things they're doing. They're doing an outstanding job of managing cattle in that part of the country, the Southern Great Plains. Specifically, it's an order buying and cattle trading operation that specializes in trading yearlings and calf crops direct from the producer across the United States. Les has got a background in a wide variety of things, whether it's some of the things producers are doing and how they can be marketed. I think you'll enjoy his insight, and he represents that part of the country very nicely. Now to go to the Pacific Northwest. Bob Harrell is with the Harrell Hereford operation located in eastern Oregon, specifically at Baker City. His family operation consists of 300 registered Hereford cows, 400 commercial cows, 800 head feedlot. He serves on the management team for the Country Natural Beef Program a program that has really grown with a lot of success in that part of the country with, and working with their retail distributor throughout the United States. It's a unique marketing co-op, and I'm sure you'll enjoy learning about that, but Bob has experiences in a variety of things all the way from cow-calf production on the seed stock side. I know he's had some experiences with the Certified Hereford program as well, and so we welcome him to the panel as well. So I need to have you guys, Les, you make sure you wave to him. Bob, likewise. And the last is a face that, and a figure here at NCBA that those of you attend regularly know, Mike John and his background. Mike has given a lot of his time. We're fortunate to have people that provide his level of leadership in the cattle industry. He has been president of the Missouri Cattlemen's Association, president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Mike, likewise, great to have you as part of the panel. Beside that, located in Missouri, he is director of the MFA Health Track Beef Alliance, a feeder cattle source and process verification program in Columbia, Missouri. He's vice president of the John Ranch commercial cow-calf operation where they do a lot of retained ownership. Excellent background in a lot of areas, and certainly his 10 years NCBA president exposed him to a lot of things. So with that, without any further ado, that's your panel members, and with your questions and a few that we're going to start it off on, we're going to start the discussion today. I want to cover a wide area, because if you leave this, our goal is we want at least each of you to leave with one or two ideas that you can walk home and implement, and so we're going to walk you through a series. The very first question I'm going to pose to this panel is, in the industry, we hear an awful lot about information being provided on cattle that has value. And so question number one to them is going to be, what specific information can a cow-calf producer, a stocker operator, or even if they wish, a feedlot operator provide on cattle that will add value? And we'd like each of them to respond, picking areas that they're comfortable with. And so, Les, I'll pick on you on the end. You're on the end, and so you get to start. Respond to areas that you think have value in terms of information that these folks can provide.
In our part of the country, one of the things that's really moving forward, of course, is the source and age verification and the documentation that goes along with it. I come from a different background than these boys. I'm more commodity-oriented. The range goes from as simple as what your vaccination program is, do you have a vaccination program, your implant program, your genetics. In my field, it's not so much to get down to the type of bulls, but where you source your bulls, where you source your cows. You know, it's just, if anything, it comes down to information overload. Too much information is always better than not enough information. And I think one of the things we have to get into the habit of is not protecting what we do and sharing it across the industry.
Bob?
Like I say, I'm from a little bit different background. I'm a registered breeder, but also have commercial cows and then involved in a branded beef program. So I take it back, I guess, a step farther back to the genetic sides, and we kind of try and target or look at what is your specific target down the road. What branded beef program are you involved with? A lot of our customers are moving away from the commodity business and moving into a branded program. So we ask, what genetics are you using, or what are you targeting? What specific bulls or EPDs do we need to be looking at? Then we need to keep track of the birth records for age verification. If you're going to do a PVP program, you know, also look at your genetic source. And then what we like is a good health protocol. We are in partnership with Pfizer on our particular operation. We're in their program. We do different weaning protocols, I should say, in our operation. The Country Natural Beef program that Larry mentioned is an all-natural program, and it's a never-ever program. We can't treat those cattle if we want them to stay in the program, so we look at other things that as weaning practices, whether they're on pasture, whether they're fence line weaning practices. We do everything we can to keep those cattle healthy. And then anything, other information that our customers might have as far as feedlot performance, efficiency, rate of gain, past performance, anything that we can pass on is helpful.
Mike?
Well, we've been at this health track thing since 2000 and have probably collected data on about 300,000 feeder cattle. And the way we collect data and the way we do it, we can probably collect anything that you want. I mean, we can store that data. The biggest problem that we've had, and probably the biggest disappointment I've had, is because of the way cattle move in our part of the country and critical mass issues, very seldom ever get either asked for that or up until just recently haven't really had a process for forwarding that information. So I think before you get wrapped up in what data that you're collecting and what changes you have to make for your operation, I think there's there are a lot of choices you can make from a record-keeping standpoint that help you in your internal operation that are a starting point for your external and added market operation. And I realize this is a little bit disjointed, but I can tell you that in our market area, which is in Missouri and part of Kansas and Iowa and Illinois and Arkansas, I consider it a massive step forward when our producers tag their calves, actually know the day the calf was born, and then weigh those calves at weaning so they've got a way of measuring their production. So in this conversation, to start with source and age verification and shot records and lot numbers and natural and all that kind of thing, is that's all fine and good, but I know that there are producers out there that haven't even started with the basics. So I think that because of the high cost and the things that are going on, you've got to look at your operation from a cost standpoint and figure out what's going to keep you in business in your region and then determine who your market is, and then they'll let you know what information you need.
With that, let's burrow into the specifics of that, and let's take a component, and I think each of you are doing some things in that area. We hear a lot about age verification. I mean, it sounds fairly simple. Everybody can, you know, what's the first day of calving or whatever, but there's a little more to it, and I think, Mike, your point of the fact that you need to, if you're going to do that, you also need to be thinking about the program as to how you're going to market the calves and where it's going to fit, because I hear a lot of frustration sometimes about that in other programs. Let's take them one at a time. You guys each covered a number of areas. Let's start with age verification. That means what, and what do they have to provide in the way of documentation?
I'm going to go first.
Please.
Age verification means that you can either identify the birth date of an individual animal or that you can identify the birth date of the first calf born in this group of calves. And that is a huge oversimplification, because in this process of determining all of that, you have to have records in place. You have to be evaluated by a third-party organization. You can't make these claims on your own. For the beef export requirements, for the countries that are demanding this kind of information, which is basically right now, which is just Japan. So if you want that to meet those BEV requirements, it has to be either in a QSA, which is a Qualified Systems Assessment, or a PVP, which is a Process Verified Program. So just because you keep the records, if you don't go through the process of having somebody come out and go through the evaluation with you and make you a certified supplier and you jump through all those hoops, that's how you age verify animals. And again, if you have individual birth records, that's fine and that's the easiest format. But if you don't, then you have to not only show how you determine the first birth date and what record-keeping system you use to capture that first birth date, but then you have to be able to identify what you do with purchased calves, how you keep them separate, if you have separate calving seasons, how you keep those herds separate. I mean, it's not that simple. But, again, it's not based on somebody trying to be a pain in the neck. It's based on meeting the beef export verification requirements for the reason that we have age verification.
Les or Bob, you want to add to that? Mike, that's great points. I think it sounds so simple. Well, shoot, I can record first calf came February 15th and last calf came whatever. It's not that simple. There's a lot more to it. There's some dollars here to glean, but each program is a little different. Bob, you want to comment on, I think you're doing some age verification with the Country Natural Program, correct?
That's correct. Two programs that I'm involved with. One is Northwest Premium Genetic Partners, which is a partnership between Thomas Angus Ranch, Harold Herb Ranch, and Beef Northwest. And one of the premiums, if you sell your cattle to Beef Northwest, that you can receive, and it's a $25 premium, is age source those cattle. It's sometimes harder than we say it is, but the thing is the value is there. The cost of doing record keeping and keeping those records for a period of 3 years is fairly simple process for receiving that $25 value. As we talk about value, you know, a lot of things that we'll talk about here today, they've probably been stated in a magazine or people have already said them, and we're going to reiterate a lot of these things. But the thing that we add value to, a lot of these things are incremental. If we're here today to look for a silver bullet, I don't think that's going to happen. But we've got to remember there's probably 10 or 15 things that we can do to add value that are incremental. And as we add all those dollar figures up, we can make profit on our cattle.
Les, you want to comment further? Because you handle both cattle that also go through yearling programs and have a unique part that sometimes tracking this age thing, it's one part the cow-calf, but then they got to go through what likely will become a longer program in terms of days as grain prices where they're at. Thoughts in terms of information that has to start at the cow-calf level, and then how do we keep track of it through a yearling program?
Well, I mean, I'm going to come at it from a, once again, critical mass. The majority of the people probably in this room today are going to have a hard time accessing many of these programs. And I know the majority of the people across the United States have a hard time getting to the critical mass to make any of these programs work. I'm all for the bulk of the programs, and they kind of threw me up here because I'm kind of the contradictory side because I trade so many of the commodity-oriented cattle. We ask y'all all the time to do the incremental things that we're talking about to pick up the additional dollars. But once again, I think the thing that everybody needs to be aware of is a critical mass statement that Mike made earlier. From a critical mass standpoint, if you don't have a load or loads of cattle, it's very hard to access any of these programs. Somebody like me that'll trade several hundred thousand yearlings a year, going from the cow-calf operation, selling them into somebody that the yearling operation is going to become more critical. The higher corn goes, the more we're going to have to lead cattle outside. Then you have not only the individual like yourselves that is doing all this work, you have to be able to market to a yearling operator that is willing to accept that work, pay you for it, and in turn get paid for keeping track of it. And that's where the breakdown in the system is in tremendous numbers of cattle in our industry. Like Mike said, he's got data on 300,000 cattle, but we had a conversation earlier today that basically said very few times does he have a feed yard after buying those cattle that call you back and want a lot of that critical information. So from my perspective, it all comes back to profitability. And all these little things incrementally that you do add to profitability, but then you have to do the research to find the person that's going to pay you for that. And I think that's something we have to be cognizant of, because for what I do, I ask people like you every day of the week to do more and to do more. And it's harder and harder for me to actually find somebody that's willing to give you the $25 a head that we were just talking about up here. And so my response in that deal is don't do the least you can, but before you sink a lot of money into what you're doing, make sure that somebody's going to pay you for it. And I know that's probably the opposite of what anybody's ever told you, but from my standpoint and from the amount of cattle that we trade, we need to find people like Bob that are willing to pay us to do what we're asking you to do.
Can I clarify something?
Mike, yes, please.
I don't want to give you the impression that we don't have people asking for data. That's absolutely untrue.
Correct.
I'd say it's almost 100% now. What I'm saying is when you decide what information you're going to keep, and you can keep unbelievable amounts of information, don't go to a lot of trouble for a particular item if it doesn't have value. But age, certainly, sourcing age, that's a no-brainer today.
Okay, that's one important area that I think certainly gotten a lot of play in the press is the whole age verification. Let's take another one that is not as new. It's been around for goodness 40, 50 years, and that is the whole area of the concept of health management, preconditioning, papers, documentation. And yet I think this has changed in the last few years, and some of the folks here in the audience and some of you in the panel here have done some things to make this work. Let's talk about health records, the kind that they can possibly keep, what do they have to keep, and Mike, I know with the MFA program, that's a big part of what you guys do, but the others as well. I'll start again with you in terms of talking about health records and things that people can do and make it work for them.
Well, I have always thought with our program that the primary advantage to being in a preconditioning program like ours, and again, we're a VAC 45, a complete VAC 45 program with a standardized nutrition component. Our goal has always been to get cow-calf producers to keep those calves at home, wean them at home, put that extra weight on at home, and add value to their operation through saving a step in that process. So when we go out and talk about what we accomplish at HealthTrack, we want to make sure that at that most efficient stage where there isn't any transportation, there isn't any commingling, there isn't any near of the outside stresses that's typical with a commingled situation on ball and calves, that we feel like we have very efficiently measured what, I mean, I've got 270,000 head of animals in a database that I know how many of them got sick, what they got sick of, how they were vaccinated, when they were vaccinated. And I can stand right here and tell you that if you follow our protocol, your risk of those animals getting sick in that first 45 days is less than 2%. The risk of one of those animals dying is less than 0.1%. So I can tell you, based on this standard protocol, what your risk is as a cow-calf producer for adding that value at your operation. And as all of our input costs get higher, we're not going to be able to keep doing the same things we've been doing, and we can't keep selling those little calves and selling them at an X dollar per head ratio and still being able to cover the cost of her mama. So I think that's been our whole direction. As we started with a VAC 45 health program, we've concentrated on a VAC 45 health program, and I think we know more about that now than as much about that as anybody.
And I think it probably learned to appreciate the tremendous value it has to those producers and the industry in general.
Yes, sir.
Bob, I think in your program as well, you also have a health program in both programs that you're involved with. Comment further in terms of the kind of records need to be kept and documentation necessary?
Well, I would say most of the record keeping is a voluntary basis. In the Country Natural Beef program, it's a retained ownership program. So it basically, the value is going to be on you. Or back in your pocket. So, the more dollars that you want to receive, the better vaccination or health program that you need. We've got a deal in our deal that all information is available to everybody. And you can take, and we kill about 50,000 to 60,000 head a year. And that equates to a little over 400 lots of cattle. You can sort those cattle any way you want. I had information and did a deal what we call the profitability index, and we took net value of the cattle and we times it by a what we call our target. I don't know if that's me or
turning mine off.
But we what we did is we wanted to create or figure out who. whose cattle created the most amount of value. So what we did is we rated those cattle in the top 20 and found that, and we looked at those cattle and we found that the cattle that were most profitable out of all these lots of cattle did more things right. They didn't excel in any one particular area, but if you take 10 traits and put them together, these cattle excelled. And one of the most important traits was health on the cattle, out of program cattle. If you have health issues, your profitability goes way down. So in a retained ownership program, it affects your bottom line. Now, some of you folks still sell your calves. A lot of you guys sell your calves at weaning time, or you precondition those cattle and sell them at a little bit later date. Well, the thing is if you send out cattle that aren't properly vaccinated, that don't perform for these guys in the feedlot, these cattle didn't make me any money, and I'm not going to buy them again. You might say, well, it didn't create value, but it will. They are not going to buy your cattle again, or they're going to pay you average price. And in today's economy, we're trying to seek above average price or above commodity for these cattle, and a good, healthy vaccination program is just a must anymore.
Les, you want to comment as well, because you come at it from a little different perspective where you're buying a lot of these cattle or fighting homes from. What What's working and what's not working with all the cattle that you guys handle?
Well, I think the first thing that I want, both these programs are great, and Mike's and them program is tremendous. I think the one thing you have to be aware of that I see a lot of people get caught up in these programs is, remember, you've got market risk over your weaning days. And a lot of people, especially this year, because of what happened, was they weaned their calves in my part of the country because of the escalation of corn prices. They didn't protect themselves on the marketing side. They didn't sell them the day that they pulled them off the cows and went on and weaned them. So 45 to 60 or 75 days later, guess what happened? The market dropped. And so you thought you were doing something to put extra money in your pocket. And what happened was is you didn't take in the health risk. Everything else is great for what we're trying to do. You didn't take into account the market risk that you were basically allowing yourself to experience over that 45 or 60 days. So by all means, wean your calves if you're capable of weaning it. Just be really aware of the marketing risk that you've got in the next 60 days to 70 days. Sorry about that. I can't reach you. But from the perspective you wanted me to take it from, by all means, any of these programs, whether you give them double vaccinations and have to ship them, you don't have the ability to wean your cattle. There's a lot of people that don't have that ability. But doing the minimum is better than doing nothing, because we won't even bid on cattle anymore that don't have vaccination shots. Plain and simple. And we trade them all over the United States. I just tell them I can't do that. Their next option is weaning them, because they didn't go in and do their vaccination programs at an earlier stage and prepare them for that. So from my perspective, there's just not a market out there anymore for calves that don't have some sort of pre-vaccination shots and vaccination. They don't have to necessarily be weaned, but you've got to do the protocols to start.
Would you agree, Les, or any of you, that one of the things that's always been important, health from a standpoint of treatment costs and, of course, death loss, but as we've moved to the cattle price structure we have, and particularly the challenges in agriculture in general from a labor standpoint, we've got to have functional cattle. And one of the high labor areas is a set of sick calves when they arrive.
Well, there's by no means. I mean, I even have feed yards today calling me and asking me if I know of anybody to be a pen rider. They're all running short of it. At whatever level, the quote-unquote cowboy that can identify a sick calf, rope him out in the pasture and doctor him, that just doesn't happen in my country anymore. The labor situation is going to continue to be a huge issue that we all face. They can go get a job at forklift driver for $20 an hour. So we're going to have to move forward, especially as higher corn prices affect us, and this we'll probably get into a little bit later, but we're basically going to get into inverted markets. We're real close to it already, where calves are going to be cheaper than yearlings, and yearlings are going to be cheaper than fat cattle, and I think that's something that we're all going to face in the next 5 to 10 years. So you're going to have to market your calves at heavier and heavier weights and take advantage of the resources you have at the ranch to put the weight on the cattle.
And if I could ask something, Les, we may need to have you take your mic, either hold it a little closer so that they can hear you. I think has that been a bit of a problem together? So there we go. We'll try that. Yeah, before we go to some other areas, one of the questions asked from the audience that I think is very, very appropriate, and that is when we talk about age and the key dollar value, because when you start stacking $15 to $20 to $25 premiums, folks, that's huge. I think we all accept that those are a lot of dollars. Here's the question, and it's been asked by a number in different ways, but I'll take this one. If Japan starts to accept cattle under 30 months, will any premium for age and source-verified cattle, will the premiums for age and source-verified cattle go away? Who would want to? Thoughts on that? How does certainly the driver? We would all agree the driver is very much the international market. That's where it all started. What happens if that age changes?
My crystal ball is not completely clear on that, honestly. I wish I could tell you that we were going to get that market changed in Japan. I mean, 6 months ago, I'd have told you that was definitely going to happen. We've got an administration change coming up. All of our export partners know that, and that may play into this. I hope we do. Believe me, I hope we get that market opened up, because it just adds that much more potential product that's available. But it depends on who you talk to. And what I mean by that is that I think that there are some outfits that are capable of taking the product that has the most value in Japan, and it's not a choice loin. It is a liver or a tongue or a, you know, it's something that we don't typically have value here. And so when you understand how animals are harvested in a packing plant, and if you don't have a mechanism for knowing that all of the tongues that end up in this tray in this particular day are cleared for export to Japan, if you have to segregate them one to the other based on dentition or whatever, I really don't believe there's a chain speed mechanism to prepare those high-value products even at 30 months. So I firmly believe that there's still going to be a value for age verification in a 30-month market. And again, I think it's just like Bob's been saying, it's all incremental. I mean, I think cattle that have that kind of verification behind them and have shot records behind them, have source behind them, all those things have value, and it depends. And if you're a once-a-day marketer in an auction facility, it depends on who's there, how many cattle are there that they can mix with those cattle and make independent lot and brand lot quantities. I mean, the critical mass is issue. That's not an easy question to answer. Thank you.
There'll be a lot more, I'm sure. Les or Rob, you want to respond at all to that in terms of thoughts in whether the age is the value premiums for age verification is here to stay, or whether this is maybe short-lived?
Yeah, I can't really comment on how long it's here for. I know that as a producer, it's here now, and it is real dollars now. I mean, I can't tell you if the price of oil is going to be $100 a barrel 3 years from now, but I know that it is right now. And so it's very important to us. But I think that one thing that will stick around is the source verification. I think it's going to be important that you sourced your genetics, you know the bulls that you have a track record, you get a good relationship with a seed stock supplier. And I think that's here to stay, and I don't think that's going to change. The source deal with, or the age deal with Japan, I can't comment on when that would change, but I know that there's real value in that program right now for keeping, you know, birth records on your calf.
Les, anything to add?
No.
If I could share just some comments. I know as a company we made that statement many times, is that we really thought we were maybe in a temporary period here on the age premiums. I think like much of what we're facing in the beef industry, these things are going to be very dynamic, and over in a very short period, some of these may change quickly. Point being that I would say in working with all packers as we do, I have heard repeatedly from that side of the industry that once we've started down this trail of age verification, some form of age verification likely will continue to exist in this industry. How will it look? How much will we be paid? You know, that's going to be like the cattle market. It's one price one day, another price the next, and certainly a lot of volatility to it, but I think it is probably part of something. But let's expand that and then take it a next step further. End of this year, supposedly, another new terminology that we've been hearing forever in the cattle industry, country of origin tied to it, source verification. Comments on your thoughts in terms of will this carry value? What's it going to mean to the cattle industry? That came from the audience. That's not one I dug up, so, you know, that's an audience question.
I'm trying to go first.
I think it'll be critical to source those cattle. I think we're getting away from commodity beef, and we're headed towards a branded beef program in all segments. And as a producer, you've got to first evaluate your resources at home. What is your management? What's your labor? What is your environment? What breed types are going to fit my environment? And then what program can I get those cattle into that will add value back to my operation? You know, we have between Country Natural Beef and Northwest Premium Genetic Partners and Certified Hereford Beef and Certified Angus Beef, we have four outlets for our customers as a seed stock provider to get those cattle into. And the thing that we try and do is a couple of those programs are complementary to one another, so that if part of your cattle fit one program, the rest of them may fit another program, so that you can receive value on your entire calf crop.
You know, a lot of times when we go to the sale barn, you say, what'd you get for your calves? And you always quote the best 30 head that got the best price. But really, to be profitable in this business, is you say, how many calves were born that year, what did they weigh, and what did they bring? And that's the money that you put in your pocket. And so as we look at these programs, we try and get programs that can utilize all your calf crop, because that's how you make the money, just not in the top 30 head or the top 50%. It's your entire calf crop. You know, how do you add value to your heifers? Whether you retain ownership or you do a heifer development program and you buy your heifers, I put a lot of merit on the genetic side of things. You know, there was a very good talk this morning, and I'm getting a little off track here, but they talk about crossbreeding. You know, this has been around for 100 years, and we tend to ignore some of those things, and we need to get back to those basics, because some of those things are very hard to measure. And it's easy for us to talk top price, talk weight, things that we can measure, but it's very hard to measure survivability. Well, it's not that hard, but survivability, mortality, morbidity, fertility, longevity. Some of these things are very important that sourcing these cattle back is really going to help.
Les, I'm not going to let you off on this one. You got a comment as well.
My background is going back before I was trading cattle. I worked for Harris Ranch Beef Company in California. Many of you are aware of them. And we throw around this branded program a whole lot. Branded comes down to what you put in a box. And I was operations coordinator in the packing division for Harris Ranch Beef Company, and they did the branded program pretty much for anybody else. And you can make a brand out of going through the cooler and market any carcass you want. Once again, when you come down to these branded programs, and there's probably 30 or 40 of them out there now, it comes down to critical mass. And the consumer in the United States, as long as you stand behind their product, you can create a brand. Look at Dell Computers. You can throw anything you name on the box, and if you stand behind your product, and it's a good product, and you can call it a branded program. Now, there's a difference when you start talking about genetic type programs. And once again, I'm going to play a little bit of the devil's advocate up here, is it comes down to critical mass. When you start talking about 50, 60,000 cattle a year, you know, I think I trade a lot of cattle. I trade about 2.5 days of kill, what we kill here in the United States. And you start talking about these branded programs, and if you throw them all together, it might be a week's kill, maybe 10 days of kill. So it's very hard to access those programs. And once again, it comes all back to profitability, because I'm going to give you a good example. Today I had some source age verified cattle. They wanted to pay a premium for the cattle. And I turned around and sold them to a commodity operator for $3 a hundred more than what I could have got from the source and age guy. So there's variables that are attached to it. One of the big things right now is what their corn positions are. So when you're trading with anybody, whether it be a sale barn, whether it be a video, whether it be somebody like me that you trade to individually or in the company, all of those things are great, but don't pin yourself. I guess what I'm trying to tell you is don't pin yourself into one branded program, because the commodity guy might have a whole different outlook, a different corn position. He may be long the feeder board. There's so many variables out there that you're not aware of. Make sure, and I might, don't get me wrong, I'm not telling you not to do it, but a lot of times, there's more money out there that's not associated with them. So don't put yourself in any one box, is what I'm telling you. Because at the end of the year, all it really comes down to is dollars per head and profitability. And to keep you guys in business so that we can continue to have a business, and that's everybody in this convention, you're the heart and soul of it, in my opinion. To get you to do that, we've got to give you as many tools as we can to make you profitable.
Since these guys didn't answer the question.
I didn't know. Sorry.
I'm going to keep track. It's one thing to pass legislation that says we're going to have country of origin label. And it's another thing to add as a component of that legislation that it's not going to be cumbersome on existing management practices. And then it's a third thing to say, we're not going to increase the record keeping or requirements or any of those kind of things that are required, and that we're not going to make that part of the law. But I've been at this long enough to know that just because they make that part of the law doesn't mean you're not going to have to do any of those things. If you're going to write rules to implement how they're going to be able to verify on a label that this product meets those label specifications, there will be many circumstances, in my view, where that will be impossible to meet without some type of identification, source and age verification, and movement tracking. And I know that most people that have always been staunch proponents of country of origin labeling hate to hear those phrases and those terms. But again, you got to remember that as a politician, it's very easy to pass a law that has statements in it that are not enforceable or not implementable. Is that a word? Probably isn't. But I'm just telling you that beware. Colin Peterson, who is the chairman of the House Ag Committee, says we are going to have mandatory country of origin labeling by September, the end of September 2008. And he's in a position to make that stick. Okay, so I suspect we are going to have mandatory country of origin labeling by the end of September of 2008, which is not very far away, which will impact calves being born right now or calves that were born last fall.
The other ramification to that right now is that the Mexican cattle crossing the borders have dropped substantially in value because nobody will buy them, because they don't know which way to hop.
Bob, you were going to add something to that subject?
Well, I realized I was way off the question. I was going to make a comment on what Leslie was saying, is that as a producer, you know, one of my goals is I love this business, and it's to pass on my operation to my daughter. And, you know, I want her to be in a prosperous situation to be involved in one of the greatest occupations in the world. But to do that, we have to be profitable. So on our operation, and this goes back to the branded program a little bit, but we kind of break it into segments. We look at, you've got from birth to slaughter to make money on that calf. Okay, that is his entire profit potential is in that period of time. So if we break that out, and we kind of use a 60% rule, is what we can return as far as profitability from birth up to about an 8 weight. And those are things that we can do. Then we look at what can we make in the feedlot phase of things, and we at first we put a 30% rule on there, is that we can make a 30% profitability. That's where we can make that much money in that particular area. Then the last was on the rail, and what can we make? But as these feed costs start to rise, the profit potential starts rising at the end point on slaughter, on how do those carcasses hang up, because it's getting more and more expensive in the feedlot. So as we talk about branded beef programs, Country Natural Beef, for instance, is based on a sustainability model. It's cost of production. And so what it is we're not a commodity pricing structure. We weren't necessarily the high of the market, but we're in the top 10% of the market all the time. And so as a profitability point, I think it's very important to look at the whole thing. A lot of guys, you know, you aren't looking clear on down the road, but I think it's something that we need to start to. But like I said, I was way off the question. So
they're going to keep each other straight, I can tell you. And when the questions get livelier, it may they'll really get going here. A question has been asked by a number of you. It relates to an earlier discussion we had in the health area, and that's the whole area of PI testing. How much effect has PI testing had at the feedlot level in terms of morbidity, mortality, and is PI testing worth the time and money for cow-calf producers selling to feedlots? Comments from any of you on PI testing? Certainly a very popular buzzword in the industry here over the last year to year and a half. In programs and cattle you're going?
Go ahead.
I know in my arena right now I do have few of my feed jars asking for them, and it's extremely beneficial on the health side of it. Once again, I have a hard time when somebody brings me a set of PI-tested yearling, PI-tested calves. They'll buy them. They like them. The premium issue, once again, kind of goes, it's a juggling act. If they need the cattle and they're in the right position, they'll pay for them. But more often than not, I can get an additional amount of money from my producer to people that aren't as concerned about it. I think that in the future it's going to become an issue. I really do. And the reason why I think that is because in the climate that we are in today and the amount of equity that's disappearing as far as private equity within the feed yard industry, more and more of them will ask for it. And hopefully at some point, I have one guy that will pay for it. He just reimburses the producer for his expense of it. And I think we'll see more and more of that. I would like to see more and more of that because we are seeing some results in feed yard. I do have two feed yards right now that I trade substantial cattle to that are completely PI-free, and they PI them when they come in. Now, the problem I have with that is when we PI test them, what do we do with the ones that test positive? The ones that test positive go to the feed yard. I mean, go to the sale barn. So I might have not bought them from you, but guess what? I just bought them from your neighbor. That's something that I don't know the answer to. I think cows need to be PI tested. We identified a cow in South Texas on one of the big ranches. I'm not going to say. Y'all would recognize the name. And we were able to track her down and get her out of the herd and send her to slaughter. Those cattle that are PI tested, I think, need to go to slaughter. Because, Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think from a slaughter standpoint there's any issue with it. So if you do have one and you do PI test, please don't take them to the sale barn. Or if you take them to the sale barn, let them know so that they'll go to slaughter, because it doesn't do anybody any good to recycle them.
From a producer's point of view, we PI test all registered and commercial cattle. We had a couple incidents in our program. We were able to clean it up right away. It's important that you do it before the breeding season so that you do not pass it on. It adds value on our operation. We have very little sickness up till probably the feedlot phase. The thing that's a little disappointing is I wish there was a bit of standardization within the industry, because we enter our calves into the feedlot that are PI tested and they may be commingled with cattle that aren't. And so it really didn't do us any good once it reached that stage. But I think there'll be enough pressure on it someday that it will be a bigger issue.
Bob, I've heard some seed stock people say, if you're in the seed stock business, unless you really want to play with a lot of risk, you better be PI testing. And that seems to make sense. I assume you'd agree with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost a mandatory. In our sale catalog, we print it, we guarantee it, and it's right there and right.
In the allowance program, how are you guys handling that?
I don't think there's any debate. I'm going to be a little more general than answer your direct question, because I get one. Because they didn't.
Okay. You straightened them out on the other ones, so now
yeah.
You can kind of, okay.
I don't think there's any debate whatsoever over the science of the cost of persistently infected BVD. I mean, I don't think that's not what we're debating here. I think what the debate is without a traceability system, and again, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about a traceability system, but without a mechanism of managing and measuring and following those cattle. I mean, from what I understand, you asked the question about whether they're safe to harvest. It's not a very high percentage of those calves that make it that far. So they get isolated and they just are fed, and hopefully they get big enough to go if they do, but if they don't, they die. I mean, and it's costly no matter what you do. I think there are testing strategies where you can mix 10 ear notches in one bag and know the animal numbers for those 10 and really reduce your cost. The very first question you asked was whether it was something that producers should do. I think every producer should do it. I think regardless of whether it has any downstream value, I think it has value on your own operation.
From a standpoint of some of the problems they have in cowherds, whether it's reproductive rates, respiratory problems, so some of those type of things, it makes an awful lot of sense for them to be doing it at their level. Let's go into another area that I know once we got into this business, we'd do meetings and talk about a wide variety of topics, and this one always seemed to be one that dominated about 50% of the questions that would come up. And we heard a lot about it this morning at some of the sessions where we had some of the restaurant people, food service distributors, and that's the whole natural arena. So let's touch on that. Is this a fad, or is this here to stay in the cattle industry? That's the first part of the question. Second part of the question, what do you have to do to be a part of the natural program? Bob, you're probably closest to this. I'll pick on you to start with. You participate in it. You've been in it for quite a while. I think it's something that's worked for your family and a lot of fellow producers that you partner with. Your thoughts in terms of where all this is heading, and what does it mean to be natural?
I'll give you a little bit more history here. In the Country Natural Beef Group, one of the requirements is that you go and do an in-store in a supermarket. And none of those in-stores that you do are usually in your hometown. They're in big cities like Seattle, Portland, Oregon, San Francisco. And when you go there, it's that you're not educating necessarily the consumer. They're basically educating you, because the consumer in your hometown is a whole lot different than the consumer in Seattle, Washington. And I'll give you a little story. There was a guy that came up one time, and he's got about a million earrings, and his ears are hanging kind of low. And I mean, he's pretty buffed out, and I thought, I am dead. This guy's going to kill me. And he just comes up and he says, "We love your beef." And, you know, I thought I was dead. And here he loves our beef because they, whether it's right or wrong, they believe that hormones are bad for them. They believe that antibiotics are bad for them. And you're, instead of arguing with that guy, you know, he's right. He's the consumer. Give him what he wants. So that's the particular niche market that we're going after, is that particular consumer. I think it's here to stay. I don't think it'll go away. One thing about natural programs is they're expensive when you retain ownership to feed those cattle through those programs. You might as well figure another dime, at least, on average gain to feed those cattle. But the premiums need to offset the extra cost. And that's why in that particular program, we have a cost of production model that takes 10 producers. We take their costs and we figure back what we need on an 8-weight to be profitable with a reasonable rate of return. And then the specific cuts that we have 40 to 50 cuts, and those cuts are then a price so that it brings back that profit to our individuals so that they can cover their costs. Now, this is a little different way of pricing your commodity. But if I am just going to go into a branded beef program that is natural and retain ownership, I'm going to have to see how that product is priced, and then I'm guaranteed that I don't enter into that program, that price slides downhill, and I'm sitting here with all these costs, and I have nowhere to go with my product.
Let's comment on that further. I know you've had positive and negative experiences as well.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer in it. Whole Foods Market is probably as good as anybody, and going a little step further, the organic beef deal. And I've been shopping at Whole Foods since it was just one store in Austin, Texas, when it got started. So I'm a firm believer. The only difference that I will say about the natural beef program as far as retained ownership is don't. I've fed several thousand of them, and if you're in a cost-plus program, like Bob's talking about, it's one thing. If you're in just going to sell your cattle into a natural beef program, sell them as yearlings, sell them as weaned calves, and let everybody else take the risk, because I can tell you the cost associated with it don't come back in the carcass, because I've fed several thousand of them, and I am a poster boy for telling you that I would have been better off every time selling them as yearlings or selling them as weaned calves and not feed them. The retained ownership model, unless you're in a situation like that they have, is very hard to recoup your cost. And you're going to get it, you know, depending on the time of year and its market timing, you're going to get a $4 to $8 to $10 premium for that. Take it, stick it in your pocket, and get ready for next year. And I'm not saying it's here to stay. It's a great program. Please produce beef for it, because let me tell you, my wife, that's all I eat at my house is natural beef anymore. And she does the shopping, but she is a firm believer, and I'm in the cattle business, and I argue with the guy. Well, I've argued with her until I can't anymore. And she thinks, just like you talked about, the antibiotics, these larger markets that we get into, that's where these people are heading. And the organic labeling, all of those things, you see it everywhere, and it's here to stay.
Mike, I'm not going to let you out of this one, so
okay.
Don't participate.
The president of AMI was in our executive committee meeting this morning, and they were talking about long-term trends and what they see. And AMI is the American Meat Institute. And the current president is a vendor of either cooked and or processed products in the Chicago area for either the restaurant trade or the manufactured food trade, which would be like frozen dinners and those kind of things. And he was adamantly trying to instill into our minds that this natural market is growing, that it's going to continue to grow, that it is something that we all need to pay attention to. From my NCBA side, what bothers me is about natural is that there are so many different standards. There is no standard USDA definition for natural that everybody meets. And so you can go, and my complaint with it is you go to the retail store and there will be four products that say they're natural. One of them is only the last 100 days. One of them is never, ever. I mean, they're just all over the board. So I think, first of all, I think standardization will come. I think there'll be standardization. The other thing in my part of the world is most of the cattle are marketed through auction markets in my part of the world. And if you can have a day where you know there's going to be a couple or three natural buyers there at the time, at that day, and you know there's going to be several truckloads of natural cattle they'll bring a whale of a premium. If not, they won't. It's that simple.
I want to add a little bit about the standardization. We sell to four different all-natural companies, and all four of them, if you go through what their sheets are, I have to keep all four of their brochures with me to see which one they fit. Each one of them has completely different protocols, and it would shock you if you lined them up how different they are. So once again, you almost have to find the most difficult protocol that you can find and match that up so that you can go to the three or four different ones. Some of them are all black. Some of them have to be baldies. Some of them go as far as allowing different products in their feeds. It's just, standardization is where we really need to push, and that'd be a good thing for us to do here.
I think that's a great point. Is in this natural area, just our company got in it a few years back, And we really resisted it. We thought it would kind of distract from our regular marketing program. We finally decided from our perspective, if we're going to do it, we try to do it right. And so the first thing is what's right, because there's about a zillion different ways of doing it, less you say. And what's right is every program has some flexibility to it. In the broadest terms of natural in the eyes of most consumers, that probably means three things. One is that growth promotants are not used. That means the calves simply were not implanted as calves. They were not implanted through the yearling program, and that continued through the feedlot program. And obviously, that's a major part of the cost that these guys alluded to, or added cost, by not using the extra pounds that you generate. Step number two is antibiotic use. Antibiotic use does not mean at the stocker level or the feedlot level. That starts with you as a cow-calf producer, and that means that when you got calves as they're born, if you got some scoury calves and those type, you've got to, if you're treating those calves with an antibiotic, those calves are documented. That paperwork accompanies those calves. So when they talk about the fact that these calves have to have accompanying paperwork, it is that paperwork starting at birth and going on through right up to weaning time or whenever they leave your ranch, whether that's a short growing program. Documentation, specific numbers, or some system is very important. And the last part is the use of animal products. By and large, if you're going to be a never-ever type program, animal products as well as the two other criteria are not part of it. So I think as a cow-calf producer, if you're going to position yourself, I would encourage you to look at it from that standpoint, but I'll really echo the part before you get very far along. You better be having an idea of what program you're targeting, because you can get yourself into some added cost. They'll come back and bite you in terms of that kind of program in a hurry. Let's keep going in terms of one part on this deal. Bob, you alluded to cost plus. Cost plus means what? It sounds like exactly what we need to be in, but what? And then the part is a comment more. Be sure that you have a buyer that is properly capitalized or understands the process. What does cost plus really mean from the standpoint? You've referred to it a couple times. I think it's what we'd like to do, but how does it fit your program?
How I refer to it is cost plus reasonable rate of return. And it's a reasonable investment on your assets, basically. And so we pay ourselves a profit. We allow ourselves a percentage of gain on our operations, and then those are put into a production model. One thing, Whole Foods is one of our biggest customers, and we try and sell other things other than a natural program. You know, Coleman is a supplier, Myers is a supplier to Whole Foods also. So other areas that we try and capitalize on are sustainability aspects. And we try and promote that our operations are to be sustainable, to be passed on to the next generations. We use Grazewell principles. We try and take care of the land. We use environmental principles. We have what is called an internal partner that we just developed that is looking into carbon credits to see if we can get money back on and trading for carbon credits on our range ground. So it's an aspect that we're trying to promote and sell. It gives a positive perception that we're doing something that's environmentally and friendly, where we have the consumer in mind, and then that's the approach that we have, that we sell ourselves or try and differentiate ourselves from other natural programs. I was thinking about this the other day that we did something, and it's like, how do you add value other than promoting it on environmental issues? You know, you guys are probably familiar, hopefully you're familiar with NRCS and EQIP and Soil Water Conservation District. We did a project the other day with Fish and Game to develop springs and water troughs on our range, and they paid for it. How did that add value to my calves? We've been in horrific droughts in our area. It increased my conception rates. I used to have watering holes, limited watering holes, and basically when you turn those cows on those watering holes, we dried them up. We lost weaning weights. We had health issues in our calves. And these particular projects have added those values as far as conception rates and weaning weights on our calves. We've turned around. We're going to document what we've done as far as the environment goes, and we're going to promote that to our customer, who is Whole Foods. It ultimately gives it to the consumer. So it paints a positive picture on our industry and our particular branded beef program.
Okay, we're going to change gears a little bit, and one of you asked a question. I think it's a great question, because it's what cow camp people do in the industry. You are the genetic manufacturer of that calf as it goes through the whole production process and ultimately to the consumer. And a lot of these folks have put a lot of emphasis on using genetic selection tools at cattlemen's colleges and many other educational events, discussions on EPDs, and these type of things have been used. A lot of folks work very hard at knowing how their product is going to hang, or how their carcasses or cattle are going to hang on the rail, getting carcass data. How do producers get paid for using the right kind of genetics, going to the extra bother of knowing what kind of cattle they're producing from a carcass standpoint? What can they do as calves move through the marketplace? Mike, you've worked a lot in that area, done a lot. I'll start with you.
Oh, boy. There is a huge spectrum here, and we've worked very closely over time. Matter of fact, I have a young man that works for me that is involved in a time breeding program, and his graduate process was to take known and proven sires that have been proven in time breeding programs with proven and high accuracy traits for carcass value, and we put those in a significantly large group of cattle, brought those cattle in, fed them, followed them all the way through, went through the harvest process. And, you know, there is way more than the value or the cost of the time breeding program and the cost of the semen that was returned in that process. So the lesson in that is proven genetics. He even took it further and went into the process of, okay, what if we take those steers' sisters, their siblings, female siblings, and kept them into the herd for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 more years, and what kind of ramification did that have on their net return and their value? And then if you add to that fact that the entire calving season on these herds is shortened and way down into 40, 50 days, where the cost structure on keeping those cows was dramatically lowered, and you had a very consistent process for measuring production between those cows. If you add all those things together, there is a significant return on using proven genetics in a program that has, where you were able to actually harvest the value at the end of the chain. Now, having said that, I've been in many of these groups that try to put enough critical mass of these genetically improved or proven sire sets. And first of all, you can't get them to agree on a sire. Secondly, you can't get them to agree on what traits that you're going to have importance in. Thirdly, most of them aren't, if they have a choice between using a proven sire with 60 or 70% accuracies on the key traits versus getting free semen to put on a production test, you just can't hardly get them to jump. So I think it's just kind of like PI testing. It's incredibly documentable. The science is easy to find. It's not hard to justify those processes. But if you don't own them all the way through the harvest, so that if you're not using that as a way to measure your value, then you've lost one of the cornerstones of that added value process. If you don't stick to your guns and use proven sires that have those accuracies so that we know that they're going to produce those kind of results, I think, again, that second leg of that stool just got pulled out from under you. So it's you know, I could go on and on and on and on that one, but it is definitely a scientifically proven process.
And there's tremendous progress that's been made in that whole area. I think we can create cattle that are very, very predictable based on the genetic information. Bob, thoughts in that whole area of what you've seen? Both of you have programs, I'm sure, that where they do the calves do go through the whole system, that the value of genetics shows up quickly. But just comment in general on what you've seen in both selling purebred cattle as well as being a part of some of these alliance-type programs.
Well, I think that our particular approach is we go to the end point and see what the carcass specifications are, and then we work our way backwards. The groups that I'm involved with, the carcass specs are probably a little tighter than some programs. Our ribeye specs are 12 to 14 inches, less than 4/10 back fat. We like them below yield grade 3 and around a 750 weight carcass. So as we do that, then we work back on the genetic side and say, what is it going to take to produce that, what we call the ideal carcass? And so we start targeting bulls that will work on cows that can fit those parameters, because there's premiums based on those what we call bullseye specs. There's a little wider range that we call target specs that we go on. We've taken it probably a little bit further in our operation, and we ultrasound all of our commercial replacement females and use that as a culling criteria within our program. One thing that, as we chase some of these extremes that maybe some of the branded beef programs do, we find that back on the cowherd side, some of those aren't as profitable as we'd like. So one thing that we try and do is we try and stay in the middle. We get rid of the little ribeyes, we get rid of the big ribeyes, and we try and pick out of the middle, and then we try and take that entire population and move it a direction that we want. And so that's kind of our goal, but we try and use those tools. But, you know, if you look at the consumer today, I mean, you'd think that I'm a seed stock guy and that my ultimate customer would be a commercial man. But the way we look at it is our ultimate customer is the consumer, and the commercial guy is the avenue to get to our ultimate customer. But when she's paying $17 for a ribeye and $27 for a filet, I think we owe it to her as an industry that if they're going to pay that much money and we're going to increase that dollar amount, that we give them a good eating experience 100% of the time. And I think that falls back on our shoulders as producers, that we have a responsibility and we've got pride in ownership that we have to produce that quality product every time. And genetics are going to be a key role in that process.
Les, you look at it from a little different perspective. You do a lot of buying. What do you like to see in terms of information on the genetic side or carcass side, and how do they make that work for them?
That's probably a pretty difficult question for me to ask, or for me to answer, just because I'm not into seed stock issues. I mean, we trade volume. There's no doubt about that. You know, everybody, black is beautiful right now. However, in saying that, in the last 5 years, we've probably decreased the quality of the black cattle that we have across the United States, not increased it, because everybody is using seed stock. Not everybody can have the best seed stock bulls. Not everybody can afford the best seed stock bulls. And so what we have found, I don't know in the Northwest, but I can tell you in the South and Southeast, we've moved a little bit in the opposite direction by keeping some seed stock in the programs that normally wouldn't, because everybody's clamoring for black. So I guess I do look at it from a little different perspective. I think you run as good a quality cattle as you can afford to run and be profitable. Not everybody can run the top end of them. And the consumer, in general, if we're going to keep increasing demand, isn't the lady that's going to walk in there and pay $27 for a fillet, and she's not going to be the one that pays $15 a pound for a ribeye. She's going to be the one that catches it on sale. So that's the one that moves the bulk of the items that we as a beef industry have to produce. Now, saying that doesn't mean that we can have any less of a positive experience than what we've had. Once again, from my perspective and the perspective of the bulk of the people that I sell cattle to, which tend to be the big corporate guys, do the best that you can afford to do, but once again, you can't lose sight of profitability. And I know y'all are probably tired of hearing me say that, but all in all, that's what it boils down to.
Mike, I think you got something you want to add.
I think something needs to be said here, too. We collect a lot of carcass data for a lot of producers that don't retain ownership. And if you're the kind of producer that keeps excellent records and has cows individually identified, has a way to at least know approximately which sires are in which pasture, and no birth dates, and you get that information back, and it can be extremely valuable on sorting and culling your cow herd and managing your cow herd, and it will be profitable for you even without retaining ownership on those animals. But if you don't meet all of those criteria before you get that carcass data back, in my view, it has almost no value, because I have seen set after set after set after set of that carcass data come back, and when you get down and you analyze it at the end, guess what? Those cattle are all about average. You'll have one that's worth a carcass that's worth $1,600, and you'll have one that's worth $800. Almost every set of cattle has that range in it. So if you can't do something about that diversity with your record keeping system, my first advice would be do something about it with your record keeping system. But don't spend a lot of money getting carcass data if you can't do something about it.
But I'll make a comment. You know, we talk about the carcass traits being the most highly heritable traits. But let's say you come to me and say, I have a program and I want to do this particular thing and I need to start breeding for it today. That animal that I start on today, you will not see that animal be killed or the results of that animal be killed for 5 years. So, I don't have my watch on. So it's still a very slow process, even if we start today.
It's the nature of the cattle business that we live in, is that what you start today in the breeding program, it takes a while till the consumer sees that product. Along those lines of genetics, these folks are getting pretty specific. Question from the audience is, where do you see genetic markers, tests such as Agenity and GeneStar and these type of things fitting into genetic selection? We've been talking EPDs. Where do the DNA technology fit in terms of providing information on these calves? Who wants to tackle that one to start with?
Why don't you go?
Okay. mean, I think we're just right on the front of this DNA technology. You know, we talk about, you know, marbling, you know, markers. We talk about tenderness. I don't know how many they have identified for marbling, let's say 4, 5, 6, or 7. There could be 60 of them. And so it is a very useful tool. It's in the infancy stage as far as I'm concerned. But it is another piece of information that we can put into an EPD that will add accuracy to that information. So if I'm just going to go buy SIRS off of a DNA test, I don't think that the accuracy is there yet. I don't think that they've found enough markers yet to utilize that data strictly on itself. But if you incorporate that data to add if you just incorporate that with actual carcass data, ultrasound data, DNA technology, incorporate that into an EPD, our accuracy levels are going to go so much higher, so much quicker. But it's just another piece of information that we can use in the puzzle.
Mike?
Well, we've just gone through a year where we've had some huge black eyes in our industry and in the meat industry with recalls. And one of the things that I can tell you, being exposed to retailers at the level I have for the last 4 or 5 years, is I can tell you that they've made concerted efforts over time to drive this industry. And I think that's a sign from above. into using traceability to limit their exposure. Okay? So although I believe that we'll use these kind of identification things for a multitude of different marketing processes, I still believe that we're going to see a desire for traceable meat products to meet these consumer demands. We heard again from the AMI president this morning about a lot of their customers wanting to have some kind of a story behind their beef. I'm not sure I buy all that, but I'm just telling you that there is more and more discussion about food safety, limiting the size of recalls, limiting, you know, just because one of those recalls, you weren't an investor in Tops, doesn't mean that didn't cost you money. I can assure you them going out of business cost everyone in this room some money. So I would answer the question. I'm not sure that some of those specific markers are the first frontier for DNA technology. I'm not so sure just general meat traceability and tying it to individual record-keeping systems in some kind of a traceable format isn't going to have more value, and not from a mandatory standpoint, but from a voluntary standpoint.
And certainly some countries, Mike, are making a lot more progress on that than we have.
Absolutely.
And it's something that if we can't do it, we're going to have some challenges. Number of different areas that we need to still address. One of those is that certainly has not caused any controversy in the cattle industry is this whole area of national animal identification. So let's talk a little bit about identifying cattle, the value of an RFID tag, just identify cattle in general, where we're going to be at as an industry. Is that going to add value? If you were to offer advice to these folks here in terms of what you think they should be doing, you would tell them what? Well, I want to start. That may be an omen in terms of how often change questions. Okay, Les, you get to start.
I'm going to take it from a different perspective. I think it's added value.
Look, you need to speak up a little bit there.
Still?
I'm having trouble hearing you. I'm getting some high signs from out there.
Higher?
Most people tell me to stay quiet.
Is that better back in the back?
Okay,
I can do that too. I think it's already added value to the MFA health program, to some of the things that we're doing in Texas, with especially those smaller producers. I think the RFID program has already added value. Some of the commingled sales that we face, the ability for people to take 30 and 40 and 50 calves and work with several thousand other calves, commingle them and get value out of them. I think that's the most direct implication. I will tell you that I am up here on the panel and I am for mandatory ID, so I think it's easily implemented.
not so much for trace back purposes, but for marketing purposes. I think it would be extremely beneficial. So I would say short term, it's already added. Long term, I hope it is something we implement in the industry, because I don't think it's that difficult. I think it translated some of the cool issues and some of the other issues out there. So from my perspective, I'm a proponent of it. It's not very expensive to get done, and that's kind of where I'm at.
Mike?
When we first started using RFIDs, either as a mandatory component of our tag set or as an option, I'd say we probably got zero requests from feeders and from buyers of those cattle based on an RFID scan. Today, 100% of those requests on 100% of the animal are made through scans of RFID tags. Now, the other point that I want to make is just buying and putting an RFID tag in a calf's ear has no value. If that number isn't tied to something, whether it's source verification or source and age verification or a program or branded program or breed or something, or if you have a system at your chute that you use RFID for a purpose other than some form of market value, you use it just to manage cattle. I know people that put them in their cows and calves just because their data collection system can utilize it and make it work just like clockwork. It pays for itself that way for those people. So it's coming. It's not the greatest technology in the world as far as its applicability at every segment of the industry so that we can make it an easily transferable process, but I think we'll get there. But I can tell you from a verified program standpoint that 100% of our data inquiries today are done with RFID scans.
Bob, you want to add some thoughts, comments in that area?
From a producer standpoint, we implemented EID through the Country Natural Beef Program basically due to the record-keeping system that we had through our finance office, trying to keep track of individual carcass data, individual performance data on 60,000 head of cattle was starting to bog down that particular segment of our program. So we implemented an EID tag. On my level, what I am waiting for is the software so that I can EID that calf at birth, enter all the records on that calf through my operation, and then have all the data that's processed after it leaves my place incorporated into the same thing, so it's not such a record-keeping nightmare on our part. So when that software is developed, we've had problems with 100% reads. We're getting better and better at it. Some of these packing houses, there's a lot of electricity and interference with some of the reads. So there's some problems. There's some technology that needs to be worked out. But when we can get it to where it's simple to plug in data at all levels and it comes right back to the source or the cow, I think it'll be huge as far as a record-keeping system.
This question also relates to the EID system from the audience. How do you see the value of the EID or source of age verification when it does not follow the cut to the meat counter? I mean, we start at the producer level. They're identified. They start through the process, but ultimately it's a product going to the consumer. Are we going to lose the value?
Well, I mean, right now the people that are using it are scheduling, for example, in an export verification program right now, they have to schedule cattle that have that known identification and that device in the ear with the data behind it. They schedule those cattle for a very specific time period on a kill floor so that they can segregate that product and know that it qualifies for that prospect. So that individual identification is not following that cut all the way to the retail counter. But what it is doing is it is qualifying a batch of product for that qualifies for a certain niche or an export component or whatever it is that the process is. Having said that, I think what I talked about earlier with on the DNA question, I don't think that solves a lot of recall and exposure and liability issues that retailers and packers and hamburger processors and those kind of people have. But I do think that it does have a market value component in and of itself today, just because the industry is adapted to the use of the technology that we have right now.
The most value that we receive is not on a specific meat cut, but it's more like offal products in our particular deal, and it's tongues. We utilize the other cuts that we can send to Japan. We use them here in the U.S. We have had some requests from some of our retail partners that would like us to track individual cattle back to the cut. We're doing a little bit of research on that because they're wanting to start selling the local aspect. If their stores are in Texas or if they're in Minnesota, they would like Minnesota producers or beef to be marketed within those. They have an hour time. If they're 7.5 or 8 hours away, then they call that local. And so that's an area that we are looking at, but it's going to be more of a packing house issue than on our part.
This is a great question that somebody posed, and I'm sure that there's others out there thinking of the same type of thing. The question is that I'm a young producer getting started in the business. I don't have a lot of cows, so I'm a fairly small operator, but I know I should be doing some things. What advice would you give me in your mind, the two or three most important things that as somebody getting started, you'd say, I think you need to do these things that will help you out financially in the long run to add value? Those two or three things would be? These guys ask easy questions, don't they? They get to start less? You've identified them? Okay.
Well, I guess, again, I'd go back to how big do you plan to be, and is your environment a big impact of what breeds that you're going to be raising? When you decide what breed of cattle that you want to get into, I would align yourself with someone who is kind of a leader within that breed who understands the entire beef industry. And when you do that, you know, if they'll kind of take you under their wing, they can get you started in the right on the right path. But if you're just getting started, it's a whole lot easier to get started towards the top than it is in the middle or the bottom. And you know, I heard a phrase a while back that the most expensive thing that you can have on your place is a cheap bull. And I believe that if you are getting started, go to a reputation breeder, get reputation cattle that have a history, and try and buy as good a quality as you can, because it'll sure save you a lot of time in the long run than trying to start at the bottom and building up when guys are already 10, 15 years ahead of you.
I'd say the number one most profitable thing you could do is to make sure that you provide a product in a high-demand, low-supply time period. That has nothing to do with what I've been talking about the rest of the day. But to give you an example of that, if you can sell a 7-weight steer before the 15th of October in Missouri, you are practically bulletproof. Because guess what? There aren't very many of them. Most everybody calves in February and March, most everybody weans in October. I'm telling you that if you really want an honest answer, the number one thing you can do is to make sure you offer a product that is in high demand in a low supply period. Secondly, keep excellent records. Can't fix what you can't measure. And thirdly, find a guy that's my age or older, that's been in the business all of his life, and get some help. That's, I told you, and anyway, that is as straightforward as I can be on that, and at least in our part of the world, from a, if you're in the cow-calf business, there are some things that are more important or more valuable in today's market than any of the other things we've talked about.
Taking that timing part, which I think is critical, because if you're going to add value, and we're going to get to some things in terms of choice select spreads and that here in a second, is the short time we have left. But, Mike, you're from an area where you have proportionately, I'm sure you know the numbers, but it may be half-half fall calving, half-spring calving in terms of the timing. Comment a little bit further on the timing, calving timing, and when these calves hit the market in terms of whether they're as calves, whether they're as feeder cattle or even fed cattle. The timing thing is it's dang important. You alluded to it.
Oh, my. I calve in the fall right now, which is not normal in northern Missouri. And I would say that, and I can see Mark Harmon sit back there, he might have a different opinion that he lives in south Missouri, but the percentage, I'd say it's still pretty close to 80-20. And that's taking out the year-rounders. Okay, that's the people that actually have a defined calving season. Okay. So
and are some of those?
Oh, yeah.
Of the couple?
Yeah, that goes back to the bull question. But
you fall calve because yours make more money than Mark's would, says spring calvers, right?
In some years.
Okay.
And again, it's just not that simple. I remember in 1993, I was calving by myself in February in some of the worst weather I have ever experienced in my life. And it wasn't a blizzard. I can live with the cold weather. It was 35 degrees and rain for day after day after day after day, and we'd have 8 or 10 calves in the utility room tubing them and trying to keep them alive. And why did we do that? Why did we go through that process? It was so I could sell a heavier calf in the fall before that flood of five weights hit in mid-October. It's a supply and demand process. I mean, that is, again, that's number one, but if you lose 10% of them because they're drowning in mud, I mean, that's not a very simple question, but it's very, very easy to analyze feeder cattle markets and figure out when those times of the year are. It doesn't take a rocket science. All you got to do is talk to Randy Block or go to the we track and have for 7 years something we call the Missouri weekly weighted average, which is feeder cattle sales, and I can show you that trend on any weight range of cattle you want, and I can show you that it troughs in October and November, and it peaks in March and April, and it does it every year. And I don't care what you do, it isn't going to change until more than half of the people change their calving date.
So taking that a step further, which is another question from the audience, right along with that, we see a lot of seasonality in the Choice Select spread. And then looking at the Choice Select spread, it's been somewhere in the $5, $6 range lately. Was as $10 last year, $13 the year before. Certainly higher than it's been over the 20-year period, which is probably $4, $5, $6. But how do I take advantage of these cyclic nature of the Choice Select spread, and maybe whether they're fed cattle or feeder calves kind of going to the market that got a lot of quality to them that seem to fit this seasonality from the standpoint of the quality aspects? I told you the question was going to get easier.
That's a real easy question. You don't. We trade them by the thousands, and the Choice Select spread is the farthest thing from anybody's minds, for the most part, when they're buying cattle. Or it basically comes down to, if they've got empty pens, they're buying cattle. If they've got wheat to stock, they're buying cattle. The timing and the seasonality of something is something you have a control in. You have control when you market your calves from the time they hit the ground to the time they die, if you so choose. Like Mike said, the seasonal troughs are easy to track. You can get them from anybody in the country. I've got 25 years of data. If you've got 6-weight wean calves right now or 550-weight wean calves, please call me. People are looking for crash cattle. It's pretty simple. You know, they bring January, February. You don't sell calves if you can get any way around it, August through December. December is the worst time to sell them, starting January 1, week over week. They get higher. They get higher till April the 31st, and then they start on a decline again. You know, one of the things that most of y'all, in our country anyway, most of our guys in the Southeast are understocked. I'm sure in Missouri most of them are understocked as well. One of the things that going forward, and I held this, had a discussion in Corpus Christi the other day with a bunch of the big guys down in that country, is you can make calves into yearlings. You know, normally when you would market them in August, September, or October, and if you're understocked, that means more than likely you've got some sort of winter grass to utilize. And pushing your cattle as yearlings or long-weaned calves into January and February is always a good time to sell them. Nobody's selling. Now, when you get to March, April, May, of course, the big yearlings are normally coming off of wheat if we don't have $10 wheat. So it's just timing's critical. I'll stand by my guns. The choice select spread is narrowed, primarily for two reasons, and the biggest one here recently is we've had more yearlings go on feed, which means they have more age behind the cattle, which means they graze better. And that's why we've seen that in the short term. We had a wet season across, grass season across, everywhere. We put lots of grass yearlings, 850 weight cattle that had age behind them. Now with the droughts around, you're going to see the choice select spread probably widen out because a lot of calves start dying normally in March, April, and May. That goes to the seasonality. Once again, that's the youth of your type of cattle. With high corn, weights are going to start to drop or have started to drop, so we're feeding them not as long, so it's a maturity issue. Just to answer that question, choice select spread, in my business, most people don't buy cattle considering the choice select spread.
Well, in another way, Mike, you retain ownership, and I'm sure that you manage towards certain target markets and some things like that. Your thoughts in terms of what the kind of cattle that you handle and produce, you want as much for them as you can. But what seasonality and spreads and that do you keep in mind with the calves that you're handling as well as some that you do for your customers?
Honestly, I wish we had that much foresight. I mean, I would say now I got a bone to pick with you. I wish we had that much planning, honestly. There are trends when the choice select spread tends to get higher through to the late spring and summer and tighter through the winter. I mean, there are things that are general trends, but I learned my lesson the hard way. We've been retaining ownership a long time, and single trait selection, as you know, is not a good thing. If you've got cattle that grade 100% choice or better, but they're all yield grade fives with a 12-inch eye or a 10-inch eye, that's not good either. So, I would contend that the animals that we kill today that have close to 800-pound carcasses that are above 70% choice have moderate ribeyes and a decent yield. They'll work any time of the year, but again, I think you're going to see the choice select spread always start up with a summer grilling season, and the marbling tends to get a little tight through the heat of the summer, so there tends to be more spread in that time of the year. Supply and demand, seasonal calves, everything. I mean, it those things all work that way. But I guarantee you that if you have prime animals in 675 weight carcasses or 50% choice animals with 850 pound carcasses, I'll take B instead of A.
Okay, one last question. We've got 5 minutes left. There's other sessions going on shortly. The last question we'll take is an audience question, and that is, and it's a great question, obviously you guys have worked at this many different angles. What's the one lesson you've learned that wasn't a real pleasant lesson that you would offer to these folks a pitfall that you'd suggest they stay out of? Les, we'll start at you. What have you learned being part of these programs that you'd encourage them to watch for? You got two? I didn't think you'd have two.
Number one is strictly capitalization. I mean, we touched on it earlier. Nobody's really talked about it since. Regardless of who you're dealing with, whether it's a program, whether it's an individual, however you're approaching it, check people's capitalization. Let me tell you, going forward, in the situation we're in this industry right now, there's a lot of people, whether they want to admit it to you or not, that are undercapitalized because they're losing lots of money. And regardless of what you do, if you sell to somebody like me, if you go through a sale barn, if you go through a video auction, it doesn't really matter. Just make sure that you dotted your I's, crossed your T's, and they're capitalized enough to do what they're telling you they're willing to do for you. Because it's going to be a trap, and some people are going to get caught in it. They always do. They get caught. We get caught in it when it's a good market, much less when it's a tough market. So that's the one thing I would tell each and every one of you, is to make sure that whoever you're selling to, their check is good. It comes right down to that.
Bob?
I would say, as a producer standpoint, is don't get to chasing extremes. Stay in the middle. match your cows to your environment, match them to your climate. The seasonality thing, I can slide cattle to fit a season a little bit more, but there are seasons that are just very expensive to feed cattle in, and that's November, December, January up here in the Northwest. That's when a lot of people need Christmas kills. They're wanting middle meats, tenderloins, prime ribs. You've got to produce a lot of cattle at that particular time, but it's very expensive to feed those cattle. As far as your choice select spreads, I don't worry about it. I get involved with branded programs that pay the same regardless of whether they're choice or select. There are programs, CHB program is one that you can fit into that. It complements another program very well, CAB. If you send your high choice one way, you can send your high select, low choice with the same premiums involved. So pick your end point that you want to go for. Don't get hung up, I don't think, in the seasonality issue, but you know, most of the money, I think, in the profitability side can be made back at the ranch, and that's the important part.
Mike?
I would say don't do nothing. And what I mean by that is this industry is changing incredibly fast. And the definition of idiocy is doing the same thing over and over and over and expecting a different result. And if you're not, you know, we went everywhere from basic record keeping to identification to source and age verification, VAC 45. I mean, all of those things add value, and they are incremental and they are cumulative, but you have to start somewhere. So my advice to you, we want you to stay in this business. My biggest fear in our part of the world is with land costs what they are, and we got people ripping out fences and planting soybeans and corn and selling cows. And, I mean, I'm such an advocate for this industry that I want people to stay in business, do something, get involved, find out, measure your product, find out what in your region, and that's not shouldn't be that difficult. Find out what's working, what people are participating in, and how you can band together as producers and meet Leslie's critical mass.
Well, before we show our appreciation to these folks, just a couple of points here, another housekeeping thing. What's really helpful to the staff in terms of planning futures is fill out the evaluation forms. Please do that. Pass those to the center aisle, kind of leave them on the ends of the table on the middle part here. Do also want to thank a couple of folks. Valerie Schofield was picking up the questions from you. We appreciate her as a back there in the back of the room as a NCBA intern from Missouri. The other one I know that you thought was probably Vanna White sorting out these questions. Bring them to me. It wasn't Vanna. It was even better. It was Patsy Houghton with Heartland Cattle Company. She is co-chairman of the Education Committee for Cattlemen's College, along with Tom Woodward, and very much appreciate the job they do in putting together the program. So job well done, Patsy. With that, let's show our appreciation to the three panels. Excellent job.
This has been a production of Angus Productions, Incorporated, the industry's information leader.